time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Dr. Gabor Maté. Dr. Gabor Maté ran a private family practice in East Vancouver for over 20 years and was also the medical coordinator of the palliative care unit at Vancouver Hospital for 7 years. For over 12 years, he has been the staff physician at the Portland Hotel, a residence and resource center for the people of Vancouver's downtown east side. Many of his patients suffer from mental illness, drug addiction, hepatitis C or HIV, or all four. He is the author of 4 books, When the Body Says No, The Cost of Hidden Stress, Scattered Minds, A New Look at the Origins and Healing of Attention Deficit Disorder, Hold On to Your Kids, Why Parents Need to Matter More Than Peers, co-authored with developmental psychologist Gordon Neufeld. And he is here to talk about his latest book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. Dr. Maté, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Mike, it's a pleasure, and I'll just say that the introduction for a couple of my earlier books, you gave the Canadian titles. They've been published with some similar, but somewhat different titles in the States. It doesn't matter for now, but anybody's interested, they can look it up.
Definitely, and find out more. You also have a website, which is drgabormaté.com. So let's start out. Tell us, what was the motivation in writing your latest book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts?
As soon as I began to work in Vancouver's downtown east side, which is notorious as being North America's most concentrated area of drug use, with an estimated 5,000 heavy injection users within a 10-block square area. And being a writer, I knew that I had a book on my hands here, just telling the stories of these people and telling about the work down there. What I didn't realize is that there are many aspects to addiction that medical science has discovered but medical practice is yet to incorporate, and our understanding of addiction is very primitive compared to the knowledge that is actually available to us. So the book became not just the stories and the often very tragic stories of my patients and my work with them, but also an exploration of the addicted brain, how it develops, social attitudes towards addiction, our political and legal medieval responses to addictions, despite the evidence that we now have, and also an exploration of healing and potential pathways for a more sane, rational, compassionate, and scientific approach to the treatment of addiction.
So define addiction for us.
Well, most definitions of addictions include some kind of a substance. Mine doesn't. I define addiction as any behavior that has negative consequences but is associated with craving and relapse and loss of control over that behavior despite those negative consequences. In other words, I'm saying that addiction is a continuum from the highly respected workaholic at the apex of the social pyramid to the street-haunted drug addict who is suffering with mental illness and is facing social opprobrium at the very base. And so that in our society, there's hardly anybody who's not to one degree or another affected by addiction, whether we recognize that or not. And in my case, as a workaholic doctor, with all kinds of negative consequences on my personal, spiritual, and family life, and I did that for many years, in my behaviors, I was not all that different from my addicted clients, although, of course, in a different realm and with different consequences.
So what do you see as then the contributing factors towards one becoming addicted?
If you look at, well, again, a common view of addiction that it's a matter of a bad choice, a moral lapse, an ethical failure, a stupid decision that some makes. When you actually look at it, you're struck by two things. One is that it's very much a condition of the brain, and you can show on brain scans and other brain studies which circuits are involved, number one. And the more you recognize the brain function, how an automatic it is, the less you think that there's actually much of a choice in the matter. That's the first point. The second point is, if you look at what shapes those brain circuits, it's now known that the human brain develops not according to some random or strictly defined genetic program, but in fact in interaction with the environment. And if you look at the hardcore drug addicts who are the, again, at the extreme end of the scale that I work with on the downtown east side, invariably they were severely abused children. The women were all sexually abused, many of the men were, and they all suffered neglect and deprivation in the emotional sense and often in the physical sense as well. Large, significant percentage are First Nations peoples, Aboriginal peoples in Canada, who are really at the, again, the bottom of the social pyramid, politically, economically, and socially. And these early experiences actually shape the brain in certain ways that make addiction, if not totally inevitable, highly likely. And the same thing has been shown in large-scale American studies, so that in large population studies, they've shown that the most significant influence on injection drug use in adulthood is the depth and duration of adverse experiences in childhood.
So what, in addition to being raised in an abusive family setting or lack thereof, then what other factors go into that? For instance, is stress a contributor to this?
Stress both early in life, already during pregnancy. If you stress mothers during pregnancy, their kids will be more likely to crave alcohol as adults. This has been shown in animal studies. If you stress mothers during pregnancy, as for example a study showed during 9/11, their children will have abnormal stress hormone levels at 1 year of age. And addiction is very often a question of stress regulation. In other words, people drink or they use drugs or they engage in addictive behaviors like eating or shopping or gambling when they're stressed. So if the early stress regulation parts of the brain don't develop properly because the parents were so stressed, not necessarily abusive, but just highly stressed, that would predispose the child towards addiction later on. And then, of course, the research shows that the biggest driver, the biggest trigger for addictive relapse is stress. So that during an economic crisis like right now, predictably, a lot more people are eating junk food or people are eating more junk food because junk foods release the same chemicals in the brain that the drug addict is after, which is to say the endorphins, which is the brain's natural opiates, and dopamine, which is the brain's natural incentive, motivation, and vitality chemical. These substances are released through addictive behaviors and by the addictive drugs as well. So when people are stressed, they'll do something addictive because at that moment that'll give them some stress relief and some soothing and some of those feel-good chemicals that make them feel more balanced and less troubled momentarily. But of course, with more craving that crops up almost right away. And in some families, postpartum depression on the part of the mother is a predisposition towards problems later on in life. And not because these mothers are bad mothers or abusive mothers or anything but loving mothers, but because when the parents are depressed, they can't have that quality of emotional connection with the child. Much as they love the child, they can't be as attuned to the child as they would like to be. And it was here in Seattle at the University of Washington some years ago that an electrical encephalogram study was done of infants at 6 months of age. That's an EEG, which is an electrical readout of the neurological activity of the brain. And they compared the EEGs of six-month-old infants whose mothers were depressed to infants whose mothers were not depressed. And they could tell from the EEG of the child whose mother was depressed and whose wasn't. In other words, the child's brain is programmed by the emotional states and the quality of the emotional interaction with the parent. And this has been shown in all kinds of animal studies and human experience and so on. And so that means that what happens to us early in life is a decisive influence in shaping how we might go later on. It's not the only influence, but it's an important one. It's a crucial one. And so that's another risk factor. And then there's one more factor in our society, which I talk about in our book, Hold On To Your Kids, which is that human beings were never meant to be brought up in nuclear families. We always grew up in clans, tribes, villages, neighborhoods, communities, extended families. As the African saying goes that Hillary Clinton was fond of quoting, it takes a village to raise a child. So in the natural habitat for human beings, children are raised by a whole network of nurturing adults. Now, that's totally broken down in our society. not only don't we have the clan, tribe, community, village, neighborhood, we don't have the extended family anymore because of economic dislocation and all kinds of stress. And the nuclear family is under such stress that both parents have to work very often to make a living. And so kids will grow up around other kids in daycares, and so that the primary connection for our children very often becomes no longer the nurturing adults, but other children. And another factor that really drives addictive behaviors is the peer influence. But the peer influence is not a natural one, it's a completely unnatural consequence of social disintegration. So there are many cultural and social and economic influences that are driving addiction, but they all come down to what environment children grow up in.
But wouldn't peer influence be there in a healthy village?
No, in a healthy village, when you walk into a village in Africa, if you're an adult, kids you've never seen before in your life will call you uncle or aunt. They relate to you like an adult, because that's how they used to relate to nurturing adults. So they're not just looking to other kids for modeling and how to be in values and how to behave. They're looking to adults. And initiation in traditional cultures happens from elders, not from peers. What happens when you get initiation from peers is you get the teenage gangs. When you get initiation from adults, you get introduced into the adult culture. And so that there's tradition and security behind that. Whereas in a gang, you have nothing but insecurity. And so that's another major risk factor in North America. And if you look at the kids who are most at risk, they happen to be the minority kids in the United States whose family life have been totally disrupted by hundreds of years of history. Very often the fathers aren't around, and these kids get into gangs very early, and they're the ones who are in jail because of marijuana and cocaine problems. And so we end up punishing people for the fact that they didn't have the right conditions when their lives began.
Sticking with talking about the influence of mothers when they're carrying the babies, we would often hear things that, for instance, smoking while you're pregnant is bad.
Yeah.
Do you think the bigger contributor there is the tobacco or the situation that is causing stress that turns one towards using the tobacco?
Well, first of all, it's interesting because tobacco, of course, is a stimulant. So tobacco releases nicotine as a stimulant, like caffeine is, like cocaine is, and like crystal meth is. So the tobacco smoker is after the same brain chemical that the cocaine injector is after. And it gives a momentary calm and wakes them up and all that kind of thing. Now, first of all, a significant percentage of smokers have ADHD, because how we treat ADD is with stimulants like Ritalin and Dexedrine, which also release dopamine in the brain. So first of all, a lot of mothers who smoke already have an addicted problem. Number one, if they have an addictive problem, it means that they've had stressed lives. And that means that, and the smoking is one way of soothing stress. So your question is very apt. Is it the effect of the tobacco, or is it the effect of the stress? So the answer is both. You know, smoking will have deleterious effects on the developing system of the child, but so will the stresses that the mother is inadvertently trying to soothe through the cigarette habit. So it's a combination of both. And, you know, a British study showed that women who are abused by their partners, their children will have more likely to have ADHD during pregnancy. Their children will have more likely to have developmental conditions like ADD, for example. And when you look at the placenta at the time of birth, there's a higher level of the stress hormone cortisol. Now, that just makes sense, because when people are under stress, they release more cortisol. Now, cortisol has a major effect on brain development and in other ways as well. So that, you know, it all comes together. You can't isolate any single factor. But what you can say is that the more stressed the environment is for a child, the more likelihood addiction will somehow crop up. And that means that in our society, with the breakdown of family and extended family and village and all that, many of us grow up under stressed circumstances to one degree and another. Most stressed are the kids who are actually abused. And they're the ones who end up in the streets with injection drug use problems and intractable ones. But again, it's a continuum.
It would appear that then the most stressed environment that there could be on our planet would be war zones. Do you see high addiction rates in war zones?
Where it's been studied, you certainly show that the kids who are grow up under wartime situations have more traits that would predispose them to addiction. I don't know if there's been a direct study linking that kind of situation to addiction per se, but it's been, they certainly have been linked to personality traits that are more likely to lead to addiction in themselves. Having said that, a lot of it depends on the quality of the nurturing relationships that surround the child. Because children who might experience stress in the external sense, but who are well ensconced in nurturing relationships, are still better off than kids who live under safer, quote-unquote, circumstances, but who are bereft of those nurturing adult contacts.
What about situations like in your book, you write about Vietnam and veterans there who were under stress?
Well, that's a typical example. Vietnam is a typical example because the study showed that after the war, when the GIs returned, 20% of them were addicted to heroin. 20%. And now there's this general myth that drugs cause addiction. You do a drug, you get addicted, which is, of course, scientific nonsense. And as the Vietnam experience showed, because after a few years, only 5% of those, only 1% of the GIs were addicted. So 95% of these addicts amongst them got over their addiction fairly quickly. Now, if the drugs by themselves would induce the addiction, they also stayed addicts. And if drugs by themselves cause addiction, then you couldn't go to the hospital and get a morphine for pain. But you can give people morphine for pain for a long time if they need it. And once the pain is gone, they quite rapidly get off their morphine so that the drugs themselves don't cause the addiction. It's a susceptibility. Now, when you look at that 1% of the GIs who stayed addicted, they were the ones who came from troubled families. And for the rest, it was the stress of the war. So now, first of all, you have to notice that out of 100 GIs, 80 didn't become addicted at all. 20 did. And for them, and for most of them, it was the specific stress of the war plus a mild susceptibility. But once they got back stateside, with the stress of the war, of a meaningless and very dangerous and cruel war, had been lifted from their shoulders, the addiction burden was also lifted from the shoulders. The small minority that stayed addicted were the ones that were highly predisposed because of what had happened to them early in life.
So do you see in other societies beyond North America then the addiction rates are noticeably lower?
Well, I mean, a good case example is that of the experience of Aboriginal peoples in North America. Before the coming of European, what we like to call European civilization, to North America, there were addictive substances here. That is to say, addictive substances that had addictive potential, such as tobacco, such as alcoholic spirits in some areas, and peyote. But there's absolutely no evidence or history of addiction on a mass scale at all, or even close to anything close to it. These substances were used in spiritual ways, in communal ways, under the guidance of elders and shamans. Now, if you look at the addiction rate amongst Aboriginal people in Canada, and I would guess in the United States as well, in our streets in the downtown east side, in our jails in Canada, for sure, you have a tremendous, disproportionately high ratio of Aboriginal people. But what happened to these people? They were dislocated from their homes. Their livelihood was denied to them. They were massacred. In Canada, at least, for generations, they were forced to send their children to these residential schools run by churches of all denominations where they were sexually and physically and morally abused. And that's that dislocation then, and of course their natural ways of making a living were deprived from them. They're deprived of them because of the land needs and claims of the settler population that displaced them. And they were forced into reservations, and their spiritual ways were invalidated, And now you have a huge addiction problem where in some native areas of Canada and reservations, you have an 80% addiction rate. And it's tragic. And the abuse is passed on from one generation to the next. And if you look at American statistics, the most likely to be sexually violated is a Native American woman. And 80% of the time by non-Native men. In Alaska, at least, that's true. Sarah Palin doesn't talk about that too much, but it happens to be a statistical fact. So then, no wonder then that these people then, you know, find addictive substances to soothe their tremendous pain, because if you look at all the addictive substances, in one way or another, they're all painkillers. And so the central question of addiction, to my mind, is, which as I say in my book, is not why the addiction, but why the pain.
And then that begs the question of then, how did you get people to get off their addiction?
Sure.
That would be by stopping the pain, wouldn't it?
That's exactly right. So when you look at the war on drugs, see, if you had a bunch of geniuses huddled in around a situation table in some room, they say to themselves, hey, we know that the scientific evidence is clear that the biggest driver of addictive behaviors is stress. How should we help the drug addicts in our country? Let's make war on them. Let's ostracize them. Let's impoverish them. Let's judge them mercilessly. Let's criminalize them. Let's throw them into jails where there's no help for them whatsoever. Overcrowded jails where they're treated harshly. And after that, let's throw them back onto the streets. That's the way to get rid of their addiction, for sure. I mean, who would come up with such a system? But that's the system we got, for the most part. Now, of course, given that what caused addiction was the lack of nurturing and support in the first place, the solution is to nurture and support people. And so approaches that meet people where they're at, even to the extent of allowing them to use their substances under, you know, nurturing supervision, wherever that's been tried, the results are great. And, you know, in Seattle, there are places where people are, there's a low threshold alcohol. You know, I think the president is called 1811, and people end up drinking less alcohol that way. And in Vancouver, we have the supervised injection site, where people are allowed to come and bring their substances and inject. We don't give them their substances. I would like to. The studies that where we do that, they show nothing but good results. But at least they're bringing their own substances. They inject under supervision. If they overdose, they get help. Lives have been saved. And people get clean needles and a sterile swab, so they're no longer using puddle water in the back alley to inject. But they're getting sterile water to inject with. There's less disease transmission, obviously. Hepatitis C, HIV, all kinds of other infective organisms are not passed on from one person to another. And people have the opportunity to receive some compassionate care, which is their first step towards some kind of rehabilitation. So that the real solution here is not more harsh and more punitive and restrictive measures, but actually embracing the addict at whichever level they happen to be at. Now, for some people, that might mean immediate abstinence. If that's where they're at, that's great. You just simply can't accept or expect that everybody will be at that level, and you have to bring them along stepwise. So there has to be a wide-ranging, stepwise, graded, compassionate, science-based, humane, medical and social treatment program, which we could do financially quite nicely if we didn't waste all this money on this retrograde and demonstrably, incontrovertibly worse than useless war on drugs.
Only a few minutes left. How much does our society contribute to addictions from the standpoint of it being a consumer society? That, well, you know, we don't have citizens, we have consumers.
Well, culturally, look at the absurdity. We point our finger at the drug addict and we say, how can you be putting something toxic into yourself that you know is going to destroy you? Then we get into our SUVs and you know, the kind of industries that we have that are destroying, you know, because of our attachment to short-term pleasure, and the consumer culture, we're literally destroying the earth. That's not controversial anymore, except maybe in the former White House and in Canada's current cabinet offices. But other than that, nobody with any credibility argues very much anymore that, you know, global climate change is not a problem for us, that we're creating because of our consumerism. In other words, we live in an addicted culture. Because my definition of addiction, again, is any behavior with negative consequences that we continue to crave and relapse into despite those negative consequences. What do you call the consumer culture? It's a massively addictive culture. And, of course, advertising exploits people's natural susceptibilities and vulnerabilities. And so basically, advertisement fundamentally says to you, soothe yourself with this particular product. This will make you happy. This will make you feel okay about yourself. Do this, be that, buy this, and you'll be okay for the first time in your life. And furthermore, without these things, you're inadequate. So without attainment, possession, you know. So that although advertisement and the consumer culture can't by itself create addiction simply because of the messages it sends out, it powerfully hooks into people's insecurities and exacerbates them. And of course, creates more social dislocation, which then feeds the addictive drive of large numbers of people. And I do talk about that issue in the book as well, just this particular dynamic of the social encouragement towards addiction.
Just about 2 minutes left. So what do you recommend to those listening who are battling with their own addictions?
Well, first of all, you have to get it that what you're doing is addictive. Whether that's work that's keeping you from your family, whether it's you spending a lot of money that you don't need to on products you don't need, whether it's eating, whatever it is, you have to get that that has an impact on your life. You have to see the impact. Secondly, you need to see, as they say in the 12-step groups, that you have no power over it, that your little ego, your little personality, its stratagems and its ideas are not sufficient to overcome the addictive problem, and that's, I've had to face that in my own life. Thirdly, buy my book, because actually a lot of people have told me that it's really transformed their lives. But the real issue is whether you buy my book or not, seek help. Go to a 12-step group, speak to a counselor. Begin at least by acknowledging the problem. That's the first step. I mean, if you don't acknowledge the problem. But also realize that inside you, there's the part that recognizes the problem is the healthy part of you. In other words, we all have a healthy part of us that can lead us towards a healing path. It doesn't matter how far we think we've gone in any kind of addictive trajectory, there's always healing possible. So you have to keep that possibility in mind and not give up on yourself.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We have just been talking with Dr. Gabor Maté, author of the new book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. And in addition to his book, you can also find out more about his work via his website, drgabormaté.com, which is drgabormate.com.